You're listening to the Homestead Radio Hour with your hosts, Phyllis and Julia. We are the owner-operators, along with our families, of the BH Ranch in Auburn. We've been a family farm since 1918, and we're here to share with you some of our experiences and to hear about some of yours as well.
So today, being April, being springtime, the topic at hand lends itself quite naturally to planting your spring and summer garden. So we'll be exploring the considerations that go into that project, things you'll need to think about here in the foothills especially, and later in the program we'll be opening to the lines, phone lines, to your calls, your tips, your tricks for starting your vegetables, for getting your soil working for you, and everything garden related.
We're going to start, as we do each time, with a portion of the show called Garden Club, in which we want to revisit some things we've done in the past and tell you what we're doing on the farm right now. Our first show was about raising your own chicks in your backyard, backyard chickens, and we just ran across an interesting fact from our local feed store. In 2008, they sold 8,000 chicks, which to me sounds like a lot.
That's a lot of chicks.
In 2009, they sold 12,000 chicks. So this chicken, backyard chicken thing is really taking off, and we hope that some of you were inspired by our episode on backyard chickens.
Absolutely. It's very easy and approachable, and if you'd like to hear that one, you can visit our program page on kvmr.org. Just click on the program schedule, scroll down to Fridays at noon, and you'll find the Homestead Radio Hour, where you can listen to podcasts and get all the resources that we put up there and more.
And we'd also like to give you a little more information on beekeeping classes. When we did our episode on beekeeping, which was last month, the Nevada County Beekeepers Association classes had already begun. But in the meantime, we found about some new ones, which Sacramento Beekeeping is holding. And our guest from last week, Randy Oliver, who is a real expert, is teaching one of them, in fact. And you can find out about these classes by going to sacbeekeepers.org. The first one is in beginning beekeeping is going to be on Saturday, April 24th. That is not Randy's class. That's another expert. And on May 22nd, Randy is having a class.
So they have both organic and traditional beekeeping, or natural and traditional beekeeping, and advanced classes as well. So that site is well worth a look if you are at all intrigued by keeping bees, because as we mentioned on our program, a beekeeping class really is a great place to start. And there's the local organization as well, which you can visit at ncbees.org.
And you can find all of this information on our webpage?
That's right, on our KVMR program page. Also, on the honeybee front, Olivares Honeybees is hosting its second annual Hobbyist Day. That's on Saturday, April 17th in Orland, if you don't mind making a trek up there, or if you're in the area. We hear this is quite an event where you can learn about pollination, increasing your honey yield, pollen, all kinds of things. Sue Kobe and Randy Oliver, two experts, are the guest speakers. They're having a barbecue lunch and bee installation demos for getting your hive started. And this does sound
charge.
Like it is free.
And you don't have to buy anything. We heard at the last Bee Club meeting that it's fabulous. If you feel like, you know, Orland's a ways, but it's apparently worth it.
Round up some friends and start a carpool.
And you'll also find this information on our page.
That's right.
So what are we doing on the farm this past month?
Well, we're thinking about getting our garden started, and we're still waiting on that because, as I'm sure you've noticed, the weather still is a bit cool. So this is where last frost dates figure in. So getting started with your garden, you'll need to know that. And your local nursery is a great resource. They will almost certainly be able to tell you the last frost date for your region. It's usually somewhere around the beginning of April around here. So we're waiting and waiting for the weather to warm up enough to plant. But in the meantime,
well, you also have to wait for the soil to become workable.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out and pick up a fistful of soil and squeeze it, and it sticks together, it's probably too wet to work, so you have to wait a while. And with these late rains, and we're having more on Sunday from what I hear?
I think so. Best to...
Especially with clay. Yeah, it may be a while before you can dig in.
Best to be patient on that one and get your plants off to a guaranteed good start.
But doesn't mean you can't plan and dream.
Absolutely. That's what we're
doing.
And
that's what we'll be talking about later.
Deer fencing as well is our big topic at hand right now on the farm. We put in some new pear trees, which are very young, tasty little leafy morsels to any deer wandering through. So, especially around here, fences are your friends, and it's worth investing that extra little bit of time to just protect your garden from deer, from chickens, rabbits, whatever critters may be in your neighborhood.
At home, we look out and say, what are we going to fence next? Yesterday, we spent the whole day fencing these little trees with chicken wire and stakes, but it's worth it because you just can't imagine how sad you feel when you've got something new planted and you look out and it's gone because the deer ate it. But they have to eat too, you know, so.
There's plenty of other things, and they just need a little encouragement to go elsewhere. And along with the warm weather come bee swarms, back to the beekeeping topic. And if you've ever been lucky enough to look out your window and see a writhing, buzzing mass of bees hanging from a branch in your backyard, you'll know what a bee swarm looks like. But if you haven't, it can be quite an alarming experience. When the weather warms up, the colonies start getting too large for their homes, whether it's a tended hive or a tree, so they'll naturally split off. The old queen will take a group of her bees and fly off elsewhere and establish a new colony, and that new colony may be spending some time hanging out in your yard.
That's true, and if you see such a swarm, I know a lot of people immediately think they need to call the exterminator because they're afraid of the bees. Do not call the exterminator because they're going to kill the bees, and we can't afford that. You know, with the troubles with beekeeping in the last few years, we need to preserve these bees. So we have some numbers for you to call. If you should ever see a swarm in your yard or when you're out driving around, get the location if you're not at home. Get as much information on it as you can. Don't say there is a swarm up in a tree. Try and estimate the feet that the person will have to climb to get it, the exact location. Somebody will come and take these bees, and they do it free of charge normally. Sometimes there'll be a small charge for time or gas or whatever. But if you call the Nevada County beekeepers again, we have some numbers for you that they will arrange for somebody to come and get that swarm.
That's right. The swarm hotline, you can contact Carla Hansen at 265-3756 or Lynn at 675-2924. And you can also usually call your county and
the county ag advisor.
Mm-hmm. They can put you in if you're not in Nevada County. These numbers also, these people can set you up if you're in Auburn or any of the surrounding areas, Penn Valley. There's usually someone in that area who'll be all too glad to come out and collect those bees.
Sure, because for example, we are on the swarm line. You call Carla or Lynn, and they will call us if the swarm is in Auburn. In fact, we were called 4 or 5 times last spring,
mm-hmm.
and got a couple of hives out of it, so.
And when you see those swarms of bees, generally they only have one thing on their mind, and that's protecting their queen and finding a new home. So they won't really be concerned with stinging you or pestering you or your kids or your pets. So they're nothing to be afraid of. Just give them a little space, and if they're in a problem area, find someone who will come and take them away.
We were laughing the other day at the meeting about the fact that somebody will call the swarm hotline and say, there's some bees in a tree out in front of my yard. They're about 5 feet off the ground. And they said, well, you know, you get there and it's 50 feet. So really try and estimate it accurately.
It has to be accurate. And if there's any yellow on the insects at all, if they have yellow stripes, they're probably not bees. They'd be yellow jackets or wasps. Honeybees are usually some combination of black, brown, and gold. So that's an easy way to identify them if you're not too certain.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we'll have a musical interlude here with Timmy, our mascot rooster, and we will be right back with All the Dirt on Gardening.
So it's time to start thinking about your summer garden. You're going to be harvesting in the summer, but you're going to be planting it pretty soon. As we said, the soil isn't quite workable yet. Some places it may be. You need to go check and see if you think you can dig successfully without having it all stick to your shovel, as clays want to do around here. But you need to start thinking about what you want to put in your garden. This term gardening for groceries has come up lately, and that exactly means what it implies. You're gardening for things you would normally buy. When you think about what you want to plant, think about what you like to eat. It's too easy to overdo it. We know we've done it in the past, planted way too much, whether you have to consider...
Zucchini area.
Zucchini, everybody's
common
bane.
One.
think about what you want to do with the food. Are you just going to eat it for dinner every day? Are you going to eat three meals a day from your garden? Are you going to preserve or freeze? All of those things figure into what you're going to plant. And make sure you don't plant things that you're not going to eat just because they're attractive plants or whatever. For example, think about cabbage. You know, lots of people in cooler climates like up here, I think you can do cabbage. Well, it's easy to stick a row of cabbage into the ground. That's probably 20 cabbages. How many cabbages did you buy at the grocery store last summer? One, you know? Think in those terms, and it's easy to think what you will really eat, and you won't waste your time or your produce.
Another good way around that is to plant in rotation, in batches. For example, radishes are one where if you plant a 20-foot row of radishes, you're going to end up with radish salads for weeks, and they don't keep that well. So plant a smaller row of radishes, and then a couple weeks later, come back, plant another row, and then you'll have continuous production throughout the summer. And this is great for anything like green beans, squash, any of those plants that tend to, cucumbers, where they'll grow for a while and then they'll kind of fizzle out. If you have another batch coming in, then you can extend your season and your crops quite dramatically. And it's really nice to have a steady supply all through the summer like that.
That's true, and that works well with something like lettuce. You don't want to plant all your lettuce at once. You're going to plant it on a weekly basis, maybe, so you keep getting lettuce through the season. Or corn. We do two plantings of corn, usually. Things like that. You have to consider how much you need. There are all kinds of charts out there on the internet and in books. You can look for a family of four, for example. It'll give you a rough idea of what you might need. For four people, you might consider five tomato plants, two hills, and we'll explain hills a little later, maybe of squash, of zucchini or other summer squash, 15 plants of corn, three teepees, we'll explain those later too, of green beans.
A few peppers, do we mention peppers? Probably three or four pepper plants is good. Again, it depends on how much you like these foods. Plant more of what you really like and try something new every year, but don't, you know, go overboard if you're not certain that you're going to use it.
And do look for varieties that are good in your area. You know, you can look through the seed catalogs and find all kinds of things that look gorgeous, but you plant them in your area and they don't work. The best place to go is your local nursery, and they can steer you into plants that are successful in your area.
That's right, especially if you're new to gardening. After a few years, of course, you'll get a feel for what grows well. And then the seed catalogs are a wonderful resource for all these varieties that you will never, ever see in the grocery store, which in my opinion is one of the main reasons to have your own garden. Because
Julia is a real seed catalog maven.
Because you can grow anything you want, the most fabulous and beautiful lettuces and strange tomatoes and
if
exotic
they work
looking
in your
flowers.
Area,
that's
though.
Right.
You have to make sure about that.
It all comes down to knowing your soil and garden for a few years, and you will if you're observant. So speaking of soil, that's a tricky one around here, particularly because we tend to have this very heavy clay soil, and that's pretty widespread around here, little pockets of other types of dirt. But if you go out and you pick up a handful of damp soil and squeeze it into a ball, if it stays into a tight, muddy ball when you poke it with your finger, if it's wet soil, that's probably clay. If it's crumblier, you might have something leaning more towards sand or loam. But around here, you can pretty much count on clay, so you'll need to dig a lot of organic matter into that to lighten it up a bit and make it more hospitable to plants, because otherwise their roots just have nowhere to go, really.
And when you do that is important. If you use uncomposted manure, say you have some animals and you have manure on hand, you can't just put that into your garden because it's too rich in nitrogen, I think.
Well, it can be acidic, it can burn the plants.
It can burn your plants. So you'll be wanting to do that in the winter before you do your garden, like at the beginning of the winter, and you know you might want to keep stirring it in as the winter goes and putting more in.
So this time of year you'll want to look for composted manure that's been already sitting out, having all those stronger compounds leached out by the rain, and just turning more into something like dirt.
And there are also purchased amendments you can use, such as limestone or oyster shell calcium, which we've been putting in our soil lately.
Mm-hmm. We do need that around here. And a little handful of oyster shell lime can help in your when you're planting your tomato plants to prevent that nasty end rot that tomatoes get, where they get this little gray, mushy circle on the end of the fruit. Calcium is supposed to help prevent that. And we did notice last year when we used less in our soil that we had more end rot problems than usual.
We forgot.
Well, part of that was rotating to a new place in your garden, which is a very good idea. planting tomatoes where tomatoes haven't grown before, but you do need to start from scratch with your soil amendments if you're doing that.
If you have any suggestions on what you've done to improve the soil here in Nevada County or in Placer County or El Dorado County, anywhere nearby, why don't you give us a call right now and quickly give us your tips. Our lines are open at 265-9555 or
1-800-355-KVMR. We'd love to hear from you. So if the clay soil is just too intimidating, if you don't want to get out there and dig it up, or you don't have a rototiller or some mechanical means of improving your soil, you can always go with raised beds, which are a really good solution, because then you can put exactly what soil you want to right into that bed, and it's all ready to go.
Raised beds are also good if you have less mobility, because you don't have to do so much bending. You can make them as high as you want, as long as you can get enough soil to fill them. So you can sit on the edge of your raised bed and work without even having to bend over. The materials for raised beds can be reclaimed lumber, new lumber. You can even use its composite materials now, like the new decking is approved for organic gardening, amazingly enough. You can use that, but do not use treated lumber, the green kind that you use for building projects, because you don't want that material that's soaked in it to leach into your soil.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty stuff. But you can even edge it with bricks or whatever you have handy. People plant in tires. You could use smaller patio pots if you don't have the space. Tomatoes and those sturdy garden plants will really grow in just about anything you can give them, so experimentation is always a good thing. And if you're considering getting a raised bed, next month we will be on the air as part of the KVMR Spring Membership Drive, and we'll be giving away raised beds as thank you gifts.
Mm-hmm, the same kind we use on the farm.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And you can also, of course, raised beds are not the only way to go. You can plant directly into the soil. You can use the row method, which is what we do at home. That usually requires a little more space. If you want a larger garden, you're probably going to want to do rows. You can also use the block method, where you plant in squares. Now, both the raised beds and the block planting, you can't use any mechanical tools. You won't be using your rototiller or anything like that in those situations. So if you want to do all the gardening by hand, do the hand tilling, hand digging, you will use beds or squares. The rows, you can, run your rototiller down the row, run your line trimmer, whatever you're going to use.
And if you're planning to grow a large garden and be somewhat self-sufficient, having vegetables to preserve and freeze, then you'll probably want to just go with planting directly in the ground in long rows, which is what we do because it's the fastest, easiest, most space-efficient way to grow a large garden. And it works just fine for us. We've been improving our soil over many years, though, so it does take a little bit of patience. And if you want to be really scientific about it, you can have your soil tested for what amendments and nutrients may be missing, but it's probably going to have you pretty well covered if you just put some compost out there, dig it in, and get some manure and a little more organic matter into your clay.
And another important thing about for success in your garden is, as Julia mentioned, crop rotation. You cannot plant the same thing in the same spot every year because it leaches the nutrients out of your soil. So if you're planting tomatoes in your first row this year, move them over to the last row next year. Put something else there. And you also have to be mindful of families of crops. For example, tomatoes, potatoes, what else is in the nightshade family? You can't. Mm-hmm. You have to keep rotating those things out. You can't plant all the nightshades in the same spot.
They will just keep using up the same nutrients out of your soil. And we do grow them in the same general area year after year, but a little bit of rotation goes a long way. We have a caller on the air. And you're live on KVMR.
You're Evan, and I wanted to offer some cool soil amendment tips. Instead of maybe opt out on the rototiller because of the compaction that can happen underneath the soil when you use that, and go for a double dig method, which is a really awesome way to amend soil. And also, I'm a huge fan of sheet mulching, and I planted tomatoes as early as February by adding about a foot of sheet mulch, planting my tomatoes extra deep, and and then partially burying them in the mulch to protect them from the frost. And by April or May, I have tomatoes that are about 6 feet tall.
Wow, fantastic. What elevation are you at?
Pardon me?
What elevation are you at?
That was actually in Auburn.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I'm convinced that it would work up here in Nevada County at around 2,000 feet or so because the mulch actually, when you have that much mulch on the ground, there's actually a little bit of composting action going on, which heats up the surrounding area around the plant and helps them grow bigger. Plus, if you're planting your tomatoes deeper like that, you can start off by planting them in a hole, and as they grow, you fill it in with soil, and it gives them a really, really deep root system to start off the year with, and then by the time summer comes around, you're going to have huge, huge tomato plants. Hmm. And as you know, last year there was a lot of really hard frosts in Auburn.
Yes.
So I'm pretty convinced that it would work this year, especially up in Nevada County.
Yeah, if anything survived in Auburn last year. So tell us a little bit more about the mulching method that you're using.
I use a modified method of sheet mulching. My preferred kind of straw that I like to use is alfalfa straw because it's rich in micronutrients and nitrogen and is a compost activator and actually has a chemical in it that increases the growth of plants. And rice straw is a really good alternative because it's so cheap. You can get it by the 1,000-pound bale if you got a truck for $15 a bale from Maxwell, California. And if 1,000 pounds is plenty, I mean, you can buy alfalfa straw all day for $10 a pop up here, but if you really want to get it cheap, the best place to go is Ross Hay Ranch down in Lincoln, and they have a super good deal on their alfalfa that's slightly rotted, so you can't, obviously you can't feed it to animals, but for plants, that's just A-okay.
Yeah, perfect for the garden. So do you put down any plastic or just the straw?
Well, what I like to do is use a cardboard weed block. And optionally, you can add a layer of wood chips on top of that, which would be inoculated with mushroom spawn, a really good mushroom up here that is edible and would be really good to grow in the garden, would be Lepista nuda, which is this beautiful purple native mushroom, and Ragusula annulata, which you can order from fungiperfecti.com, is another great garden mushroom. And the great thing about that is you can just sheet mulch your entire garden, lay down your wood chips, and then put down the straw where you're going to have your bed, and then you're going to have, then you can basically have the outline of your path be where all the wood chips are exposed, and have all the straw be where your actual beds are.
Oh, okay. And now I've heard of using mushroom spores and inoculating your garden. What exactly is that doing? Helping with the composting, or...
Plants form mycorrhizal relationships and bacterial relationships with all kinds of microorganisms, as you probably already know. In fact, the richest place in microorganisms is directly around the root zone, which can contain up to 1,000 times more fungi and bacteria than any other portion of the soil. So inoculating your garden with mushrooms will essentially make your plants grow a lot bigger. And if I was going to do that, I would add some endo and ecto endomycorrhizal fungi to the mixture too. In fact, I make a really, really good worm tea, which includes endo and ecto mycorrhizal fungi and worm castings. And I like to add some stinging nettle too, because that's really, really, really... It's just like alfalfa. It's really rich in micronutrients and, you know, comfrey. There's so many cool, like, concoctions you can make with worm tea these days.
Well, that sounds like a topic for a future program here. And this would be a good time for us to mention that we are starting up a Homestead Radio blog. It's at homesteadradio.wordpress.org. And we would love to hear from all of our listeners if you have tips like this. Go right on over there and leave some comments, and maybe we'll get some discussion going. Thank you for your call.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the air. I really appreciate your program and what you guys are doing. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Good.
How long, before you hang up, how long have you been doing this? It sounds like you really, really know what you're talking about.
I've been doing it for a couple years, and, you know, I've read the entire designer's manual and edible food forest gardens. I had, like, 4 organic gardens last year, you know, and I founded the permaculture production crew out of Sierra College in Rockland.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, we're working to transform our communities into more sustainable, diverse, amazing, beautiful human living structures, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for all the information. If you would like to go to our
homesteadradio.wordpress.com.
If you would go there and leave us your name and address, we sure would like to get in touch with you for a future program.
Or just email us at homestead@kvmr.org.
Oh, I'll definitely be contacting you.
Okay, hey, great. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We have another caller. Oh, we had another caller.
And you're live on KVMR?
Yes, hi. A good little program you guys got there. I've got a quick question. I moved into a new house, and I got clay soil everywhere, but I built a planter box for one Cabernet grapevine that I just had to plant because I've been carrying it around with me for years, and I want to have it grow up a trellis along the side of the deck. I was wondering if I could plant tomatoes and a grapevine in the same big planter box.
They should be just fine growing next to each other. We have tomato plants growing right next to our vineyard, pretty much. So,
Okay.
As long as there's enough space in the box and enough water and soil for them, there shouldn't be any problem with the two growing together, I think.
Well, that's what I imagined, but I wanted to double check. Okay,
yeah.
Great. That's good.
Is there a reason that you planted a Cabernet, or you just had it?
Because I got it as a present, as a bonsai, about 10 years ago, and I've been caring for it and moving it around. In a big plastic bucket, and I said, I got to get it out of this bucket because it was so root-bound.
Okay.
And I finally built the planter box in this new house that we just moved into in Grass Valley. And it looks like it's happy. I've had it covered with canvas sacks because of all this cold weather up here.
Yeah, they're a beautiful plant, but you know the grapes are not really delicious to eat.
I like looking at grapevines. I don't care if I even get a grapevine.
Oh, okay. I just didn't want you to be disappointed.
No.
All right. Well, thanks so much for you.
I'm not looking at the next harvest of wine for Grass Valley.
Okay.
Thank you much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye. We have another caller.
And you're live on KVMR?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm down in a flat in Woodland. I had a couple things. Actually, the guy who just called, who wants to plant his grapevine, interesting thing about clay soils is clay binds potassium really strongly. And so he should consider, when he plants that thing, to bulk feed some potassium into the root zone, maybe some distance from the plant, because... the clay pretty much makes most of the potassium unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I'm maybe like 3 pounds.
Okay.
Dig a hole out away from it and water in that hole, and it should work for about 3 years.
Okay, that's what I was just going to ask you. What did you mean by bulk feed? So he understands what you're...
People try to, you know, if you try to surface water, potassium or KCl into the... In the first place, chloride ion is really bad for grapes. In the second place, is you're not going to get enough potassium into it. Grapevines have they have a huge need for potassium.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the grapes will rob the permanent wood of potassium until finally your rootstock will die unless you give it a good dose of potassium about every 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing about clay soil is, it's interesting. Have you ever heard the saying that clay is like the best soil in the world, but there's only 2 days a year you can work it?
No, but that's absolutely true.
Because you really literally need to let it dry out enough to where it will break into clods.
Yes.
And if you're going to start a new garden, or if he's going to be breaking ground, there's going to be no substitute for waiting until the top inch or two dries out and then hitting it with a pick, going around and getting vertical fracture zones in the soil,
mm-hmm.
and then turning the clods over by hand.
Okay.
And then get some kind of organic matter, straw. I use my corn plants for that. I let them lay over the winter, and then I chop them up in the spring and use them to hold the clods apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the clay will eat that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives the plants some pore space for their roots to go, because otherwise, if you till it, it just scores a new pan.
Right.
Yeah,
you just
absolutely.
Get a pan under the pan, and so you may as well go for raised beds, because
right.
you're not going to have a... anything that's going to work.
That's
so
true.
So it's hard work, but basically about I hit the pick. I hit it about once every square foot.
Mm-hmm.
And just give it a nice good whack, and then throw the shovel in, turn it over, and if the shovel doesn't score the earth, then I just turn it over, and then I till in whatever kind of straw you can get. It works real good.
Yeah, that's going to scare a lot of people. That's hard work.
Yeah, well, that's hard work, but I'm just talking about the initial, if you're just starting out with a garden, I mean, anywhere you're looking with a clay pan, don't till it. Break it vertically first.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, you'll just be doing it again next year.
That's true. And once you get your clay amended and reduced to the point where it's nice and workable, it's going to stay that way as long as you just keep it.
After the first or second year, you'll be able to stick a shovel in it as far as you want. You won't need the tiller anymore.
Right.
But there's no substitute for the pick work.
You're right. You put in the work at the beginning, and then you're good to go.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And being careful, again, about, like he was saying, working wet soil can be a real problem because you're essentially making cement and it'll just get packed down and be impassable. But this is a good place to bring in a deep-rooted cover crop, like mustard, for example, that has a deep taproot that will break up the soil. That also helps to get a little more air down there.
Oh, we have another caller. Caller, you're on the air at KVMR.
Yes. Hi. I don't know if... the speaker could address how to take care of or how to eliminate mold, white mold, I guess it is, and aphids organically, and I'll take my answer out of the air.
Okay.
Thanks. Mold and aphids, that was?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we have another call. Maybe someone is calling in to answer that. And you're live on KVMR.
Hi. I wasn't calling to answer that.
Oh, okay.
But there is a marvelous outfit called greenmethods.com where you can get natural biocontrols. And I got rid of Japanese beetles that were just devastating my roses within a few days with the nematodes that they mailed to me. Very inexpensive, really effective.
And what was the site again?
Greenmethods.com.
Okay, thank you.
But I just wanted to mention that these clay soils, I really don't want to scare people, but we do, it's very, very important, too, to supplement with phosphate.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite deficient around here.
That's a good point. And another good reason, especially if you're planning an ambitious garden, to get your soil tested and find out what exactly is going on in your particular soil, because this can be so regional.
Well, yeah, that's true. And it's also endemic up here that all the soils up here do need a lot of phosphate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So thank you so much for your great show.
Thank you.
Callers, we're noticing that some people are dropping their call before we get a chance to answer it. We don't have any kind of a lineup system here or anything, so if you're calling, just stay on the line and we'll get to you when we're through with the previous caller.
Back to the mold and aphids, those would be two different problems. And I think... with mold, a lot of that can come with... The only time I notice that in our garden is if there's poor air circulation, not enough light, not enough air or warmth to really dry things out. So if your garden, especially your plants, are staying wet, you can have mold or mildew problems. And if anyone would like to call in and address that further, that would be great. But I think spacing your plants adequately and getting enough air circulation is a good way to combat that. As for the aphids, spraying with water is... usually the prescribed organic method. There are insecticidal soaps and sprays you can use. I've had good luck with a garlic juice spray, which you can purchase, this concentrated garlic juice. You dilute it with water and spray it on the plants, and it both kills the insects and repels them, which is a handy method to have in your suitcase when you're out there in the garden. But aphids are one of those things that we hope our plants are strong enough to fight them off, but if not, then stepping in with just a good, vigorous spray of water can help.
Well, the water we found doesn't really work, though, especially if you have a large amount of aphids.
Mm-hmm.
Or delicate plants. You have to spray them too hard. But the garlic juice works pretty well, and it's completely organic. It stinks, but it's, you know, it's
it
all
stinks
right.
for a day, and then it goes away.
And it doesn't smell like nice garlic when you're cooking. It stinks, but it does go away.
It dissipates pretty quickly, but the insects apparently can still smell it. So, again, if you'd like to call in and share your advice, 265-9555 or 1-800-355-KVMR. So on to plants and seeds as well. We'll open up that topic for discussion. If you have any advice for starting plants or seeds for your garden, and this is a good time, even if it's too cold to be planting out, you can be starting your squash plants. Tomatoes you'll probably want to have going, but if you purchase nursery starts, you can repot them, which is what we often do to get them growing a little more vigorously before you put them in the ground. Mm-hmm. And we have another call here. You're live on KVMR.
Hi, I had a suggestion about the powdery mildew.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I found that not doing any overhead watering in the afternoon or evening helps a lot,
mm-hmm.
or to avoid it altogether if you can.
Yeah, definitely. If you can keep the water on the ground and off the plants, or like you say, not in the morning or evening so it gets a chance to dry off.
Yeah, I noticed a big difference with that.
Okay, great. Thank
and
you.
And that's a tough one because... There's nothing
yeah.
quite as relaxing as standing out in your garden in the evening with a little sprayer going. We all know it's wrong, but it's so pleasant.
Right. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
And that would probably help with the mold problem as well if you are having mold on your plants, just keeping the water off at the times of day when it's not going to dry quickly.
Right. If you're planning on starting your own seeds, now would be the time to do it. 4 to 8 weeks a lot of the seeds take to germinate, so if you have the room indoors to set up a little...
A windowsill or something like that.
And we have tomatoes on our windowsill every year.
And it really is best to use a lighter soil. You don't want to go out in your yard and dig up clay and start seeds in necessarily, because chances are they'll just rot if it's too wet. So something lighter, peat moss, compost, or a seed starting mix from the nursery is a good way to go for that. We have another call. And you're live on KVMR.
Yes, I have a question for you.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I live up on Banner Mountain on the east side, about 3,500 feet. I have an established bay laurel, and next to it I have four struggling star jasmine. The bay laurel is doing beautifully, and right next to it, these star jasmines, they just struggle. They don't look real good, and I'm wondering if there's something about my soil that likes bay that doesn't like star jasmine.
Could be. We have some star jasmine growing in the ground quite successfully, but it again, soils vary so dramatically from one region to the next, you know, just
yeah.
over a couple hundred feet.
Sure.
So it could be... Go ahead.
Is the laurel large? Does it shade the...
No, not at all.
Oh, not at
I've
all.
Kept it pruned,
okay.
and it's only about 4 feet tall and about 8 feet wide.
Because star jasmine does like a fair amount of sun.
And this is a southern exposure.
Mm-hmm.
It gets lots of morning sun up until about 1 o'clock or so. And so I don't know. Does it need more basic soil? Does it need more acidic soil? I'm sure this is a pretty acidic soil to begin with. Should I be putting a lime on it?
That would be a good thing to look up. If you have a resource like the Sunset Western Garden Book.
Yes, I do. I've got Rodale, too.
Okay. If you might check through there and see if there's any tips on the acidity, like you say, about the soil.
Okay.
And always organic matter is a good thing, but I don't think you'd be able to work it in around an established plant so easily. But maybe even just something as simple as a little mulch could help.
Sure, but I've been doing that. You know,
mm-hmm.
I've been putting mulch on it every year. I try to keep them moist, not dried out. Because of the southern exposure, it gets pretty blasted. So I keep them mulched, not heavily. But I've never really fed them anything. You know, I have put composted stuff on them, but no other amendment, high nitrogen or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well...
Okay, well, I'm going to look into Rodale's and maybe the Sunset Book and see if they've got some suggestions about soil that they like that the, you know, the bay is just doing so well, and I just wondered about these.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have another call here. Maybe somebody has some advice.
Okay, well, thanks. Thank you for your show.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And you're live on KVMR?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
I guess that's me?
It is you.
Yes, you're live on KVMR.
Hello?
Yes, go right on ahead.
Oh, hi. I've been raising about 30 plants of turkey food over the last 4 years, otherwise known as grapes.
Oh, turkey food.
Ah, yes.
I lost them entirely 3 years, and I got about a quarter of them 1 year, so... I'm about to give up. Got any suggestions?
With the crop itself losing it to the turkeys?
Losing it to the turkeys, you mean, yes.
They're eating them.
Yeah, you know what?
Wonderfully well-fed turkeys.
We have had that problem at home with our grapes, as well as other animals that enjoy them, and the only thing you can do is fence them off. If you have...
Yeah, I can't do that.
You can't do that. Okay, well, you know...
Fortunately, turkeys aren't so...
Not the kind of fence that would keep the turkeys out.
Yeah. Oh, well, it doesn't take much.
Bird netting is good.
Bird netting works.
The lightweight kind.
Yeah.
We use that on our grapes anyway because of the blue jays and the other birds that just love to snack on them. So if you can cover the grapes with some lightweight bird netting, that should be enough to discourage the turkeys. But if they're really tenacious, so then covering them would probably be your best bet.
They are.
The bird netting is the easiest thing to do. It requires a helper, let me tell you that right now, because it twists and sticks like crazy. But it's effective, and if you can cover your grapes, you just toss it over them, and they should be okay. Maybe the turkeys will still get a few, but they won't get them all. So, good luck.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
And if you have any more tips about starting seeds or plants, getting your spring-summer garden started, you can give us a call. Again, the last frost date is important to keep in mind here, so checking with your local nursery is a great way to find out what that is for your area. And we do have another call. You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the great show. I always enjoy it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm a little naive. I'm down here in Sacramento, but it seems to me that my dog takes care of the turkeys.
Oh,
I mean, that works.
That's one way to do it.
Fly. I don't know if people are aware. They definitely can fly. And they seem to come around with the dog. Is there some problem with that?
They could just sense that it's in the area, and I'm sure that a dog would give a turkey pause if it came to trespassing on its land. So that's, if that works for you, that's great.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. On the subject of planting your seeds or your plants in the garden, it also depends on how big of a garden you want to have. If you're going to be planting a small kitchen garden for 2 to 4 people, you're probably not going to want to invest in a lot of seeds. The best way for you to go would be to buy already started plants at the nursery. So, you know, go to your local nursery and look. You're going to see varieties that work in your area, and you're going to see things you want to eat, and that's a good way to just go get started. Go buy some plants. You won't be doing that yet unless, as Julia said, you want to transplant them into gallons, which is what we often do at home. You still have to keep them in a protected area.
We did that last year with our tomatoes, put them into little gallon pots and set them in the greenhouse. And by the time we got them in the ground, they were already 1 to 2 feet tall, and they just took off. So it really did work very well for us.
I used to put a little advance effort into it. We have some more phone calls. My goodness. Hi, caller. You're on the air at KVMR live.
Hey. Hey, just a quick suggestion for the one gentleman who's... one plant is thriving and the rest of them around him are not.
Okay, good.
Sounds kind of like he needs to do a soil test to see what he's deficient in. So the local UC Master Gardeners here in town could probably help him out with that or let him know really what's going on. Around, you know, as you folks have said, the soils around this area are really different than what may thrive. You know, what thrives for me doesn't necessarily go for my neighbors.
Yes, that's true, yes.
So maybe, or Peaceful Valley Farm Supply, I found, has really been helpful with those sorts of things. So, and thanks for the program. I learned an awful lot listening to you guys.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And thanks for your call. Thanks. We hope the gentleman that called about that heard that. That's an extremely good idea to get the soil tested.
And the Master Gardeners are a great resource. They're here to help you. So I know they have a website, the UC Cooperative Extension. Is a great place to go for all kinds of things, and they can get you in touch with your local Master Gardeners as well, who can help you out with this sort of thing. And we have another caller.
Hi, caller. You're on the air live at KVMR.
Hi. I have a question.
Yes?
Last summer, I built a raised bed garden, and I used pressure-treated wood. Is that really bad?
That is not good, yes, because pressure-treated wood is treated with chemicals that are not safe to eat and that they could leach out into your soil. I know it's an appealing idea because they don't rot, but it is not recommended. So if you can replace them, that would probably be a good idea.
Yeah, the plants can pick it up through the soil, through their roots, and transfer it to the food itself. So if you can put that lumber to work elsewhere, that would be great.
Yeah,
okay.
And a building project.
But, yeah,
and you can... If you don't want it, if you want it to last forever, you can use the new composite materials. They are safe for organic gardens, as we just found out. So.
Okay. Well, having already built the raised beds and they've been in the ground for a year, I mean, would I need to replace the soil too?
It would probably be a good idea to be safe to replace the soil. Yes. Unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
And, Carla, you're live on KVMR.
Yes, calling about buying plants, whatever they might be, tomatoes or whatever, from these markets that provide them, you know, the Home Depot or wherever it might be.
Uh-huh.
What's the chances or how can I know that I'm not getting bioengineered plants or seeds that have been biogenetically altered or whatever they call that?
Well, if you want to be certain of that, buying organic starts is really the best way to go because legally they cannot be genetically modified. I don't think that's too common with starts at nurseries. They're probably not going to be buying genetically altered seed, but If you want to be certain, go organic, and you don't have to worry about it.
Or at least at your local nursery, ask, and they should be able to be honest and tell you where their seed came from.
Yeah, that's another good reason to patronize the little guy, because they'll be so much more willing to talk to you, and they'll know exactly where it's coming from.
I know the big places are a lot cheaper, but you get what you pay for, or you don't get what you think you're getting. So, yeah, it's better to go as local as you can and as organic as you can. Thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're coming up right on the end of the hour here. Thank you for all your calls and for tuning in today. And you can visit our program page at the kvmr.org website. Just scroll down to the program schedule tab. Look for the Homestead Radio Hour on Friday at noon. Click on the link and you will find our page. We'll have some links up there, resources, some of the resources that people have called in about for this particular show will be listing there, as well as places you can find guidelines for how many of which plant to plant for the size of garden you'd like. We'll have the master gardeners up there. Everything we've talked about will be online for your perusal.
There's also a podcast if you care to listen to the program again for any reason.
Absolutely. Or either of the past programs on chickens or beekeeping will be up there as well. And if you'd like to share additional tips or comments, please do click on over to homesteadradio.wordpress.com. And that is our new blog page, so we'll be listing all those resources there as well, and we would love to hear from you.
We'd love to make that into a community resource where everybody shares their ideas. So if you live in the listening area, anywhere in the listening area, we're interested in what happens in your garden as well. So
absolutely. And you can email us, last but not least, at homestead@kvmr.org.
You can also let us know how you like the program, because we're new. You know, we're looking for comments. So.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. So I think we've given you a pretty good idea of how to start your summer garden today. Again, just think of what you like to eat and how much of it, and start daydreaming about those summer pasta dinners and salads.
Right, and it's so nice to know where your food came from, and having watched it grow, and you're getting something real, you know, and it does taste so much better. Plus, it saves money, you know, especially if you like to shop at the more expensive places that sell organic goods or whatever. When you're growing it yourself, as I say, you know where it came from, it tastes great, and you are saving money. So give it a try. A garden does not have to be in the ground. You can have a container garden. There are many plants that grow on your patio in pots, things such as carrots, cucumbers, eggplant, lettuce, peppers, spinach, squash, tomatoes, all of those things grow beautifully in containers. So if you just have limited space, if you live in an apartment, put a few containers on your balcony, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I know when we, whenever, every year we go to our local nursery to pick out some tomato starts where we want one of this and one of that, and they have many varieties of tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, peppers, that are designed to be grown in patio pots and in small areas. So those are really perfect if you'd like to grow a small-scale garden. And you can also pick out individual varieties of heirlooms and all kinds of fun stuff like that, and have produce that nobody else has.
True, and children love container gardens. They really do, and they can grow their little pot of cherry tomatoes or whatever. So give it a try. It's worth it.
And in honor of National Poetry Month, that reminds me here, I ran across this wonderful little snippet earlier from Edna St. Vincent Millay from a poem called The Strawberry Shrub. Strawberry shrub, old-fashioned, quaint as quinces, hard to find in a world where neon and noise have flattened the ends of the three more subtle senses, and blare and magenta are all that a child enjoys.
That was a nice lead-in, wasn't it? The container cherry tomatoes.
Yeah, if you have any children in your life, make sure that it's not all blare and magenta, that they get their hands in the dirt and understand where their food comes from, too.
Right, just like you always did.
Absolutely. Well,
thank you so much for all of your calls today. This was really exciting to have so many people listening and calling in. We enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Listen again next month when you'll have another episode of the Homestead Radio Hour.
Indeed, and Amigo Bob is up next with Organic Matters. And we'll leave you with a tune that just seems oh so particularly perfect.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe but don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging.